It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we'll be talking about how humans think and make decisions in the context of an urban natural environment. We'll explore some unique projects that our guest has done with his students to create ecological signage along waterways, using the arts to teach science. And with us today is Dr. Patrick Lee Gentry. He's a lecturer in the biology department at the IUPUI School of Science. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is great. So why don't we start with, I think people don't realize that urban ecology is very unique among ecology and in the field. And ecologists, I think, wasn't it up till about the 60s or 70s, really were studying more what we'd call natural pristine kind of areas. And then they kind of woke up to thinking about studying urban areas. Is that true?
Yeah, that's pretty close to the timeline that things happened. Trying to find pristine environments untouched by human hands and studying those. But as the world becomes more urban, it's projected, 2050, that most of the world will live in an urban setting or suburban environment, started to realize that our interactions and our actions on the planet actually should be studied. And look at the actual definition of ecology, you know, how does the natural elements interact with each other, as well as the non-living parts of the environment. How do those affect living things? Realize that our actions in building cities and structures really do have an impact on wildlife, and that deserves study in itself and has become a real big sub-study of ecology.
Yeah, it's interesting because that timing, 50s, 60s, 70s, that timing all coincides with a whole lot of other things where we started to look at things a little differently. You know, civil rights, we were looking at Vietnam War here. Things across the world, Australia was beginning to look at it. But you're right, I think that it had this impact at about that same time after the Industrial Revolution and the wars. We all of a sudden said, whoa, something's really happening. Not just our people moving into cities, but there's actual nature there, which I think a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah. There's plenty of nature in cities, and it really depends on the history and structure of the city. Indianapolis is a fairly green city when you look at it compared to others, but yeah, there's plenty of wildlife in the big cities, and the more that become involved with some of these international networks, like the Urban Wildlife Information Network, you see that there actually is a lot of wild things, including, I know that this is a radio show, but my screen on this Zoom conversation, I have a picture of a coyote that has come up to one of our camera traps, and it almost looks like he's smiling. At least in my eyes, and posing for the camera. So, and when I interact with students on campus, it's just the idea that just across next to the river, there's which runs right next to campus, that there's herds of deer and packs of coyote and foxes and mink and other things roaming around where a lot of them are staying or going to class. It's actually an eye-opening experience for a lot of them.
Yeah, and it's unique to Indianapolis that there's so many rivers. We have so many waterways in Indianapolis, but it's also, aren't waterways, don't they create those corridors for, you know, wildlife movement within a city?
Yeah. So that's one of the big kind of discoveries, I guess, of some modern ecology is the need for interconnectedness between green spaces. And our waterways create these natural corridors for wild things to move from one patch of green space to another, especially in Indianapolis. A lot of what our cameras are picking up is that they actually need these. And a lot of it's because we tend not to build right next to the rivers. They're a buffer zone between where humans live and where the animals are free to roam without our interaction. Coyotes, deer, they try to avoid us as much as possible. They only interact when they think we're not around. They might sniff into our garbage if they're hungry, but for the most part, they want to stay away from us and live their life and try and find their natural food sources.
Yeah. And that, you know, that idea of corridors and, or, you know, early the rivers were, and then I know railroads also provide a corridor. Again, Indianapolis being with a lot of at least abandoned railroads and railroads that are still intact. And, you know, it's interesting that we don't realize, I think, a lot of times that those urban corridors are really important for the movement. And so that's why when someone interferes with it, in other words, somebody decides they do want to have grass or lawn all the way down to the river when they're doing a development, that's a serious problem in a lot of ways, but it's a serious problem for animals.
Right, right. Yeah, so I think one of the key take-homes, I guess, from at least from, you know, from my perspective and trying to educate students, who a lot of my students are happen to be, I have a lot of non-majors biology classes, so we focus on people who aren't necessarily going to be biologists. Some of those are other degrees within the school of science, but for the most part, a lot of my students happen to be elementary education majors, social work, things like that. So try to get them to think about, you know, what actually lives in our city, what are the conditions that allow organisms to exist, and then get into that idea of kind of a cultural carrying capacity. So in ecology, we have this idea of a carrying capacity, how many organisms or how many individuals of a species can the local environment support. Well, there's this idea of a cultural carrying capacity, where how much what type of population and what type of organisms will humans accept, right? So you know, and I've even heard conversations in like the biology office and talking about coyotes and people afraid of them. So there's a lot of fear around certain animals. Hawks, I'm on next door in my neighborhood, so there's always an occasional post about a big bird and hiding your cats and dogs. And so this idea of what are we willing to accept and really not be afraid of, and maybe even welcome into our backyard, so to speak, is kind of a big talking point, one of the main themes in the classes, and getting them to think about how really these organisms aren't something to be afraid of, but really something to accept and realize that if they have a good space and a healthy environment to exist in, then we also have that healthy environment, healthy living space to live in. And we also get into some of the you know, cultural ideas and you know, different perspectives, and depending on where you live and how much access to green space, there's all kinds of topics, but really just getting into that idea of how can we be better cohabitants and not see ourselves as superior. So what you're saying about how we develop, are those really good developmental practices? Should we get rid of all the nature for or what isn't a nice green plush lawn, kind of a monoculture of what do they call it? Blue, what's that? Bluegrass growing on your lawn, right? So, you know, maybe that's not the best way to approach growing lawns in this area. So, not trying to insert my ideas, because I'm really a country boy. I grew up in what used to be rural Hendricks County. It's really developed quite a bit since then, but a lot of my appreciation for nature really comes from growing up and on a big farm and going out and looking for critters and with my brothers and really exploring. And it's been fun to kind of apply that into a professional setting, and then also getting students involved, especially since a lot of the students tend to be from an urban or suburban area where they might not have a lot of experience with nature. So, but yeah, the getting them to understand the need for, you know, what makes a healthy ecosystem, how does that relate to us? How does that relate to the animals that live there? How can we be better cohabitants of this space and realize that one is not separate from the other, where our health and happiness is really intertwined with the wild inhabitants of our city as well.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, one of the things that I hear in what you're talking about, and, you know, it's something that we should be thinking about, is we often think about, I would guess, we hear the words sustainable development or sustainable cities or whatever. But rarely, I think, does that actually include sustainable for other than humans. And so right. What you're talking about is a practice that of sustainability that extends beyond humans into the rest of the living world.
Right. And you know, that comes down to your opening question too, right? So kind of, I think a lot of it comes down to our, and again, this is my opinion, and right, I think a lot of this comes down to our cultural understanding, and a lot of it's, you know, I think based on our common Judeo-Christian philosophy where we'll have dominion over nature, and we're kind of set apart from nature, and that really has been reflected in science and culture for so long. And I think a lot of the movement towards studying urban ecology is really that understanding that we are not outside of nature. We are actually a force of nature, and we have massive ability to shape and sculpt the world around us. So how do we interact with those forces of nature, and how are we a part of it? So that really needs to, I feel like it really is still working its way out into other parts of our society. I think there is a understanding that we have the ability to affect climate, we have the ability to affect wildlife, and then seeing ourselves as not above nature, but part of nature. And, you know, I don't see coyote as something to be feared, but a distant cousin that we should be looking out for and helping protect, because our existences are really intertwined. I think that's important to keep in mind. And what's good for us in the short term isn't always what's good for us in the long term. And it's so comfort and aesthetics and things like that are very short-term goals instead of long-term, quote-unquote, sustainability. And that really has to incorporate all of nature, because we're really dependent on those systems to be able to survive, grow food, have a stable and predictive climate and seasonal changes from year to year. Those are things that have really grown our society.
Yeah. I think what you're talking about as well is that there's this the concept is of urban ecology is really broad. And so you're talking about really an interdisciplinary approach that looks at, you know, through the social, you know, social sciences as well as biological and chemistry and all that, because we have to understand how humans behave and we need to understand how we can modify that behavior. And that really gets into, you know, social science very definitely.
Oh yeah. And that's why excited to be working with you, Mark, and trying to study what, how the public actually interprets the world around them and what makes a good citizen scientist and who wants to be a part of, you know, river cleanups and animal biodiversity blitzes and things like that. What actually draws them to do that and what kind of benefit do they see getting out of it? You know, it involves people like other collaborators I have, like Gabe Filippelli and his lab, and we're doing a summer project where we actually are going out and looking at lead contamination across the city and in Bloomington, and going to look at bioaccumulation in other organisms like worms and birds that eat them, like the robin. And a lot of the health of the environment can also be a proxy for looking at how lead contamination gets to our children. So that's another example of that. What is dangerous for us is also dangerous for and possibly damaging to the wildlife and vice versa. So yeah, these things are all connected. And that, I think that's, you know, the perspective of ecology is, you know, how does one thing affect the other? It's a very important connection of life to understand those relationships. And like I said before, I think it's really important to realize that a healthy environment, a healthy ecosystem really is a benefit to everything, including ourselves, and especially for the long term.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, I think you phrased it eloquently in that interconnection is just not, it's misunderstood. It's not that we don't really get the idea of that we're part of a whole. And, you know, as much as we kind of can do it with, you know, some television ads or whatever we put out there, it's really down to what you just said and something that we do as well. And that's getting people out there walking about doing, you know, seeing the connectedness of all that. Seeing walking along a waterway is an amazing thing, but even more our friends, you know, the Friends of the White River in Indianapolis that do floats, you know, the people can get on the water. Well, you have a whole different perspective of the city from the water. It's completely different.
Yeah, just getting people out. And that's, you know, part of this, a lot of the things that I try to do on campus is not have students just learn from me talking about these things and, you know, kind of speaking from the podium, but I want them to get out and actually experience it for themselves. So a lot of the things that I've incorporated and worked with you and other people have really been focused on how can we get students to see, you know, the issues that are going on, whether it's lead poisoning, whether it's, you know, climate change, whether it's ecological diversity and how to sustain it. What does that actually mean in your local environment? So working with research partners on campus, either at IUPUI, Butler, you know, wherever, and incorporating that research into lessons and having students actually take a part of that. And especially with the urban ecology, and I want to preface this and say that I'm not a trained ecologist, right? So I have, you know, my training was literally being really excited about animals and bugs and all the things growing up. And I actually have a lot of, you know, most of my training as a scientist has been cell biology, genetics type of background. So going into getting my teaching assignments at IUPUI, most of my students were, again, non-major. So maybe not spending a lot of time on cell division or transcription, where it's hard for students to see a direct relationship. So really refocusing a lot of the class structure to things that are big topics. What are the big issues in biology that can really be related to personal lives? Well, what's the biology of toxins in the environment? Well, we have, Filippelli lab on campus that is, he's known for studying environmental heavy metal toxins in the environment. He's doing this project. Let's have students actually help collect data, have access to that data, make conclusions on their own, figure out what the actual impacts of lead is and who's vulnerable, who tends to be exposed to these things. You get into topics of environmental justice, and not because I'm sitting here saying, this is the case. They just help discover this on their own, right? So they're interacting with it and seeing, oh, this is a problem. A lot of people think of lead poisoning as something that happens, maybe if it's, an old building that has lead paint, but lead is pervasive and still an issue for young people in this country, especially in old industrial areas like Indianapolis and the other parts of the Rust Belt. Whether it's climate change and ecology and how those things affect us, doing this really got started with, doing nature walks and having them collect, essentially be bio blitzers for the city and going out in green spaces and using apps like iNaturalist. Well, then we started collaborating with the Center for Urban Ecology and Sustainability at Butler, working with camera traps, was able to get some funding for that. And then also with Christine Picard and integrating how can we use molecular biology and understanding of ecology, that using blowflies as an environmental sensor for biodiversity. I think that is an amazing project that able to incorporate with students. We actually had students go out and collect blowflies. And for people who don't know what blowflies are, of course, they're the usually shiny green flies that fly around. Sometimes you see them on flowers, but most of the time you'd see them on dead animals. So they're corpse flies. Well, we know that female flies, especially mostly, are the ones that are out sampling dead animals in the environment, looking for a suitable environment for their eggs to lay so their larvae can develop, and they eat those dead animals and help, clean up our natural areas. So what we can do is catch some of those flies in the process of looking for a suitable place for their eggs. And as they are doing that, they actually sample parts of the corpses that they're on. And when they do that, part the cells and the DNA is in their guts. We can actually collect it, dissect out their guts, amplify vertebrate DNA using PCR, and then have it sequenced. And we can actually look for sequences that are similar to organisms and find out what type of get a sampling of organisms that are out in the environment. So it's another way to monitor kind of the biodiversity of our natural area. So looking at these different projects and having students involved and making their own products and synthesizing their own thoughts and making those connections has been, I think, very powerful for students and for me, because I've learned a lot in this process, and just really being excited and getting not only myself and the students, but also our research partners, because they're like, this is amazing. These kids that they're not scientists, they don't necessarily want to be scientists either, but they're really excited about doing this and learning a new way and seeing how it connects. And I guarantee it'll be one of the things that they remember about their college career and take on to the next level. And then, of course, we're working on the art side of this with you and the Da Vinci Pursuit. I think is very exciting as well. And we can talk more about that next if you want.
Yeah, I just one last thing on what you were talking about, and that was, I think what's really amazing is how much we learn from each other. And you were talking about, it's not solo. We sometimes think of science as being solo, but it's really quite a team effort to get out there. And it includes people that are acting like scientists who may not be professionally there, like your students, but coming up with fundamental questions. And maybe it's sometimes, and I think that's the insight you're giving us, and maybe sometimes it's the one that isn't going to be a science major who might have profound questions because they don't know too much about it.
And right.
So they're seeing it very fresh.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's that fine line, right? You know, you kind of got to know what box we're talking about to think outside it. But I think, you know, once you show the boundaries of the box, then that's where you can start saying, oh yeah, have you thought about this? And yeah, some of the most profound questions about and ideas and kind of revelations have really come out of the things that I've been doing with students. Like, I wish I actually had the quote with me now that I'm just now thinking of it, but it was like the most beautiful thing that I heard from a student about what they learned over the semester. And it was like, that was the most profound thing I've seen. And, you know, all these different perspectives, these different backgrounds, students that, you know, connect with something or other, like, for example, with talking about lead poisoning, I've had several students that, you know, IUPUI has a lot of first generation students and a lot of underrepresented minorities that come to campus, and had several students say, yeah, I grew up, the projects I grew up in Northern Indiana had a lot of friends that had severe lead poisoning, or start talking about, you know, especially with ecology and outdoors, a lot of, you know, talking about green space access based on where you live. Those are conversations that have come up, not because I'm like, hey, do you realize you don't get access? No, these are things that organically come up, and, you know, who has traditionally had access. And, you know, the more you get into it, like, you find out that, you know, from a cultural perspective, a lot of Black, African-American people have, you know, they have this almost like description, well, they're not outdoorsy. Well, if you go into the history, it's because they were actually prevented from going to our national parks, public parks, green spaces, things like that. Well, it's hard to develop a family of campers and outdoors people if an entire generation or more of people were actually actively discouraged from that. And then you compound onto that a lot of the green space and stuff in poor or minority, minority areas, they're just absent. And a lot of that's because those are formal industrial areas that lower property values. So, you know, our history, our the things that we've done in the past really have impact on people today. And a lot of the times it's just making those connections through science and saying, you know, we can measure this effect. So why is this effect happening? And, you know, the students are, I mean, I think a lot of times young people get a bad rap, but the young people that I interact with on day-to-day basis, semester to semester, are really, really thinking about these things. They really care about it. And it's just giving them the opportunity and the space to do it, I think is important.
I agree. I've been talking with Patrick Gentry about this whole idea of getting students involved in the urban setting, trying to understand the connectedness. And really what's exciting about his project is working also with the scientists who are doing research in a variety of areas. And we'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend.
Sunday is your day. So do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
I'm Mark Kiesling, and I'm having a conversation with Patrick Gentry, who teaches at IUPUI students in urban ecology. And Patrick, one of the things I think that's so important is the idea of how we get students to have a deeper understanding of some of the really big issues. And, you know, one of them I know that comes across all the time is the idea of climate change. And I know you have some insights as to from your students. I mean, we learn as teachers, we learn a lot from our students that help us to be better at teaching. But can you describe some of those insights?
Yeah, so some of this comes from some research I do with students. I've got a IRB approved questionnaire that go through. And so at the beginning of class, so my big focus really, and one of the inspirations for doing this is kind of understanding how, you know, what are the perceptions of students or of people in general, really, but focus on the students in the class with a non-science background. And what are their beliefs? What kind of interventions actually change beliefs, and kind of try to break down the subtleties of it. Insights on climate change, for example, you know, ask students in some of these surveys and even in some other ways is like, what are your perceptions of climate change? And, you know, for example, in the United States, especially, there's a lot of debate on even the validity or reality of climate change or and what it is. Overwhelmingly, I think a lot of our young people, most of them that I interact with in those surveys that are anonymous, agree that there's climate change and that humans are a cause of it, at least the primary cause. Now, if you ask them why are humans and how are humans impacting it, what are the actual processes that are involved, you know, can they make a debate, can they explain it to their friend, those kind of questions, almost all of them say no. And it's, I think that's part of a lot of the, you know, if I was to say there's a problem with American education system, I think we spend a lot of time covering a wide breadth of topics. It's the whole inch deep, mile wide idea. And I think as you're growing up, and it, you know, I always try to put myself back in the perspective of my younger self before I've put these ideas together myself, and say, you know, what was it like for me? Well, I didn't really have a lot of time or space or ability to kind of make connections myself, because either going too fast or the content was kind of shallow. We're just worried about memorizing some things for an exam that I'll forget later. So one of the things that in the class we try to do is give plenty of opportunities for discussion, to look at different sides, really go into processes, spend a lot of time on, if this is true, then what would you expect? What kind of evidence would you need to support it? Give case studies, have students look at, their own carbon footprint through some calculators. But not only that, but ask them to reflect on it. And, you know, what did they know before? What was surprised them? What do you think they can do about it? And that's where I think we really need to allow our children and young adults time and space to do, is really to think of these things and make the connections themselves. I do very little, preaching or talking about the things. I do give information and try to make complex processes simpler and easier to understand. But given those facts, I say to them, all right, now what does this mean to us, right? So giving them plenty of time to do that. And I think that's one of the things that really makes an impact. And one of the, you know, see a lot of the attitudes really start to change more to the really confident, I really agree, instead of, you know, I think this is true or thing. And then a lot of the comments that we see when open-ended questionnaire at the end, they're like, you know, I really appreciated having, instead of just a bunch of topics that we cover really quickly, going in depth and having time and to really discuss and think about it. On the other end, you know, it's not all roses, that, you know, we're still dealing with, you know, shortened attention spans and things like that. But I still think the majority really appreciate that time and space and ability to interact with it.
Yeah. And speaking of, you know, those attention spans and using a variety of techniques, and it's not just, well, among our youth, we, I think as a society, have very short attention span.
Right. But well, we say young people, and then I see people like my mom and my grandma when she's alive, always on their phone. I'm like, all right. So it's not just our young people.
But you entered into a project with us, with the Da Vinci Pursuit. You were looking at trying to use the arts, and you did a particular way of looking at it. And it was exciting. I want to describe that project.
Yeah. So this is really, I almost feel like you should be talking about it, Mark, because it was, but no, this is exciting. Always looking for ways to have an authentic product. So I did about seven or eight years in focusing on high school teaching. And that's where I was really inspired to do a lot of project-based learning. And for those that don't know, project-based learning is having an authentic question, right? An authentic challenge, or it could be, you know, it really anything, as long as it's something that ends up with a real result, right? So when I went to you, you were the one who was like, hey, let's do this. We have this idea. We want to put out these metal signs along trails and riverways. And it's like, yeah, that would be awesome, because then that actually gives them something to shoot for. So you came up with this kind of challenge and, you know, talked about how to design it, gave the exemplar, and really was just up to me to implement. So it fit really well with the idea of urban ecology and these other things. And what we do is so incorporate a lot of field work. I actually have field work days built into the schedule so that they're not just sitting in lectures. So they get a few days. And a lot of students, especially, you know, we don't have a lot of really wealthy students, so a lot of them have to work full time. So we need to give them time that they would normally be sitting in class, but just go out and do a nature walk. And they go out, take photos, a lot of times using their phone. Sometimes if they have a camera, they can use that and upload it, but using the iNaturalist app. And that really limits, I think what helps with the students a lot is they don't have to be a nature expert. They can use the app and the artificial intelligence, and they'll get them in the ballpark of what that animal is called. They have the ID, and they're like, okay, and now we can work with it and find out more information about it. And they develop these artistic representations. And I have them do a little bit more for my class. Like, they have to explain a lot of things about the animals they found and do a presentation. But ultimately, the main product is they've developed a public-facing product. So this artistic design sign, where you've asked for an image that can be either a high quality photograph, that could be their drawing. And I'm actually very impressed that most students seem to have gone for the original artwork. Mm-hmm. And it's really come out better than I could have hoped for, really. And most of these students aren't, you know, Heron School of Art. There are a few, but most of them aren't. But they come up with these really good designs, original prose, and then on the back they talk about things that we can do to be better cohabitants of this space we call home, right? So it's been really exciting. And then this semester, actually, haven't had a chance to share with you, but had a blind student this semester, and really kind of forced me to think about this project a little bit, because it's very it's very visual. And so we had to think about it, and that's the good thing about, you know, making relationships with students, is you can have these conversations. And I talked to the student, and he's actually recently blind, so he hasn't been blind his whole life. He's an adult. He's been blind for about 3 or 4 years, I think is what he said. So he doesn't have, it's not like he's been with it his whole life. So he has this, so when we were talking, it was like, you know, what would be really cool is, like, you're a formerly sighted person, right? And now you're forced to interact in this very sound-based place. So actually asked him to just go sit in different areas, like compare, like, you know, the soundscape. And he actually, in one of the parks, I guess he heard the sound of a wild turkey. It was, and he wrote this poem about it, and actually recorded the sound for it. And I think it would be a good addition to a sign. Like, we could do a QR code or whatever.
Absolutely.
And go to that recording of his voice describing this wild turkey that he had heard. And, you know, and then he found out more about it, and, you know, the reintroduction of wild turkeys into Indiana, and they've really taken off. So it was actually a really cool modification of that project, and kind of forced to do it, right? So but in this with that also takes me to the idea of, I actually learned this from my oldest son, who's in school, and in one of his art classes he was exposed to this idea that a lot of creativity isn't in having unlimited supply or unlimited options. It's actually in the restriction of choices. And, you know, if you limit yourself, you're actually forced to think of things in new and creative ways. So it was really an opportunity to kind of think of, well, how else can we express this, and how can people of different abilities interact with this type of project and this type of experience as well. So it was, I think, really powerful for both of us to do and incorporate that.
So, you know, it's been my, as you know, since for quite a long time, but since 2009, when I started Da Vinci Pursuit, it was the idea that we can use the arts as a way of getting people to be curious about the world around them and nature and science. And I think your experience dovetails with mine and many other places. When you do that, I think it's allowing them to be free to find ways to express themselves. But then it's that, you and I have talked about this sometimes, but it's that slowing down. It's that you look, and this is the way, you know, the way naturalists used to have to do it before they hit, you know, the advent of the cameras were big, or they didn't have those. So it was illustrating, or it was writing and taking notes or noticing sounds. And we didn't have our ubiquitous phone that we could record all that.
Right.
And I think even though you have the students with that, they're still having to make more meaning out of it. And what you're doing is not forcing them, but you're kind of, I call it a Trojan horse. You're kind of giving them something that doesn't feel very threatening. And then they get immersed into the science part of it and get really interested, like your student with the turkey.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think the key here is, you know, yeah, our society, and, you know, even in science in general, has really been focused on the technology, big data, trying to get a lot of information fairly quickly. But that's not how we learn, right? We're not computers. And you know, it's easy to think of our brain as like this augmentation with our phone that has connectivity to the internet, but we really learn by making connections in our brain with things that we know or think we know. So our experience, so, you know, connecting it to, you know, childhood experiences or current experiences, or, you know, finding out, you know, a long held belief is actually not completely true. Right. So those are ways that we make connections. That takes time, that takes purposefulness. And it also helps to have, you know, opportunities that kind of take us out of our comfort zone a little bit, but where they also feel supported and welcome to do it and have the space to get feedback and, you know, on what they've come up with. So I think, you know, for those listening out there, you know, have some patience with yourself and give yourself the time and opportunity. Allow yourself to be bored out in nature and maybe take a book or, you know, a microphone or something and just think about what's out there. And I always enjoy just, you know, what's that sound, and try to figure out who's making it out there. And then, oh, that's that. And
yeah. And then it becomes really, this is where then the technology does become really useful. I've been using, I'm in a new environment. We just moved, and I've been using the Merlin app, which I would recommend to people to get, but the sound identification part of it, not where I know what it is, but where I don't. And it's a brilliant app because you can hold it up. It hears better than I hear in terms of the different bird sounds. And when right. that particular bird comes on, it tells you what it is, but it also goes back to it and highlights it. So you get all this, these different, you know, the same bird can be making multiple sounds. And so you get this idea that, oh, wow, I knew a red-winged blackbird, for instance, in one field setting, but I didn't realize they made other sounds.
Right.
And the app is smart enough to do that. So I agree with you. I think it's about getting out, slowing down, but then you can bring the technology into it to help you get better at being able to recognize what's around you. And it's just really fun, I think.
And you said that's the Merlin app?
Merlin. It's by the Cornell.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was used for a long time. Our listeners would find this interesting, but it was used for a long time for you to input the birds that you found and then have a database and somebody could look at them and help you identify. But they got, with artificial intelligence, they got really smart on being able to have so many recordings of birds of the same one in different settings that professionals knew what that was, right?
Right.
That they have that built in there. So it's listening for those sounds, and then you literally have a list on your phone of what it's hearing. And every time it repeats, it highlights that thing.
Oh yeah, that's cool.
And so for me, that's one. Another one that my wife uses all the time is one that's a plant snap, where she's able to just take a picture of a leaf or a flower, and it goes out and searches a Smithsonian database to give you some clue as to what that might be. And so that's one where I think technology enhances our ability to see and hear and that, but also it causes us to slow down and listen too. It's a really interesting way of technology being able to do that. And then, like you said, I think everybody should take a sketchbook and get out with it and write in it and draw and do whatever they want and not worry about it. You're not going to have a gallery show with this. You're just
right
trying to capture for yourself.
What you're saying kind of, you know, it really reminds me of some of the things I've been thinking about before. Like, you know, I think a lot of it is that there's this perception that everything's known and discovered.
Right.
And, you know, what's the, you know, why do I need to go out and do that? Or, you know, it's all been done. And it, in reality, that's not true, right? There's, I mean, our planet's one of the, we still have plenty of places on the planet that we haven't discovered or explored or examined in detail, especially if we include the oceans. What about 94% of the oceans haven't been explored or looked at by human eyes anyway? And then, you know, even if it has all been examined and discovered, you haven't, or I haven't, right? So, you know, just going out and, you know, finding out what's out there for real, who's in your backyard and things like that. And, you know, realize that you, whether you know it or not, you're sharing, you know, your residence with, you know, wild things, and, you know, there's plenty to explore and discover there. And I don't know, it, to me, that's very exciting and enjoyable. I know not everyone finds that, but
no, but
I would encourage others to.
But I think people find it if they try it. And
yeah,
just a reminder, Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, members of the community to engage in conversations like we're having today. Both Patrick and I, and I really encourage you to have these conversations, to get out in nature. The Japanese have a thing that they call forest bathing, which is just really actually being present, sitting. And I loved Patrick's idea of a book. And we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation with Dr. Patrick Gentry about how we can think of the environment, get out in it, and be encouraged. He gets encouraged daily through the work with his students, helping them to really use the arts to explore out in nature. But you know, there's some really interesting, I think, questions about how when we have been in urban environments, and you began to allude to this, but when we're in them more and we don't go out and we don't really get into the nature, and we, and what I mean is we don't have to go to a state park or national park, but in the nature that's around our city, when we don't go out and we don't do that, are we losing something as humans?
I think humans need the natural world. And, you know, it's not just me who thinks that, though. There's a lot of authors and scientists who have studied this. Even our children, you know, they find that, you know, stress, anxiety is decreased just by being in green spaces. And I think that's why there's such a need for public green space, and why that there should be more attention to who doesn't have access to them and where they're missing, or why there's just an inaccessibility or cultural stigma around it. So addressing those and kind of the history of it. But yeah, I think, you know, we do lose a little bit of ourselves. We lose a little bit of our humanity when we forget, you know, we come from the natural world. We are a part of it. That and kind of realizing our relationship to all of life on the planet, and how not only are we dependent on it, but what we do has impact, and also making connections with our place, our actual place where we are, and what are the connections there. And so, yes, long answer to to your question.
It does. I mean, I think even among psychology, I've been reading that there is a thing that they've identified as a nature deficit disorder, something where we really do absolutely need it biologically. We evolved that way and we need it.
Right. And I'm not surprised that we've pathologized it. And, but I think more importantly, I think we should just, instead of saying it's a pathology, say, look, just get out and
enjoy it.
Yeah. 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 Don't deprive yourself. And that's really what it is.
It is.
Now I feel, Mark, I this thought came to me, and I think this is important too. One of the things that I'm starting to see actually more of, and I think is actually here in the past year or so, starting to see a lot more people out in these corridors, and not because they're hiking or enjoying it, but because they're forced to as a living situation. So we're seeing a extreme amount of homelessness in our city, and I've really noticed in the past year in our city a lot of our what would be considered corridors, these easements on rivers and, you know, infrastructure where just people are having to take up residence. So a lot more tent houses and things like that. So I think that's another way of how, you know, our economy, our social networks, our actions actually impact nature as well. So instead of, you know, seeing deer movement or coyote movement, we're actually seeing a lot more people just walking through. And
that's really interesting because, you know, it's for the same reasons that animals use those corridors.
Right.
And people
for shelter,
for access without being afraid.
Right.
Of either being arrested or being hassled in some way. People can move from one to the other along there. They're, the source of being near the water is really important.
Right.
Usually they're on waterways and under underpasses, which do provide a better sense of shelter. So I think that's, you know, that's a really interesting perspective because, again, this gets us around to so many of our things in the environment. And again, this is where ecology is looking, are related to the idea of social justice. And I think I think urban ecologists and people who teach it, we profoundly need to be aware of that. It's not just the nature, but it's also people.
Yeah, and the things that impact people. And I was actually just watching a TED talk on YouTube about the scientist Dr. I think his name was Tyrone Hayes. He was an amphibian biologist.
Okay.
And he was studying frogs and especially about a compound that actually feminizes frogs and lowers fertility. And then he was saying that these kind of compounds are from pesticides and how it affects the farm workers and how most of those farm workers are underrepresented minorities and poor people, and, you know, getting into it. And he actually got a lot of kind of pushback, not only from outside groups that or the chemical industry, but also from even other scientists. Let the science talk, right? But not his point, and I'm gonna echo that, is that not everybody has access to the science, because a lot of the times these are in journals that are hard to access unless you have institutional access that pays those subscriptions or you actually go out and seek it. It's not just readily available to everyone. And then also in every field or specialty, they have their own esoteric language that is often inaccessible unless you've had training in it. So I think it's our responsibility to kind of call out these things as we see it, right? So we're seeing our fellow humankind struggling, and that's also making an impact on our the wildlife in our city and putting pressure on our natural resources and things like that. So I think, you know, it's an important issue to bring up because, you know, the politics and the social structure of our society is really letting these people down and having to, you know, just their need to survive is putting pressure on our wild resources. So those are definitely things that we have to take into consideration as citizens, as we hold our elected officials accountable and hold each other accountable and try to be better stewards of our environment. That also means being better stewards of each other, right? We can't ignore the plight of our fellow man because that will ultimately affect us somehow.
I think, you know, that's an incredible summary of what we've been talking about. And it's really is about humans. It's about nature. It's about our interconnectedness. And I really want to thank you, Patrick, for engaging in this conversation with us. And until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.